For 40 years, our castaway has occupied a unique place on stage, screen and radio. He made his reputation during the 50s and 60s in revue and on the London stage. He starred in some of the masterpieces of radio, like Hancock's Half Hour, Round the Horn and Just a Minute. He made an international reputation by being a regular in the Carry On films. He's been described, and rightly so, as one of the great institutions of British entertainment. He is Kenneth Williams. Kenneth, do you think you might take to the solitary life on this desert island?
Oh, yes. I'm very practical, Michael. After all, I did my war service all over the place. India, Burma, and some of the conditions under which we lived were primitive indeed. Admittedly, we were backed up by army logistics, but every now and again, you were left in some of these encampments with the bare necessity. You really had to use some imagination to eke out what food there was available, and you had to do things like make a fire and cook with very primitive materials, just a Dixie and stuff like that. I don't know whether we'd even have a Dixie on the desert island, of course.
You can have them, certainly. Yes. What about music? Wouldn't that be a boon, a companion to you? I mean,
yes,
isn't music
been,
important to you?
Always been a great solace to me, yes, and my tastes have always been toward the funereal, the dirge-like in music. I love things like Requiem Masses. I love the Requiem for it, and the one of Brahms, Deutsches Requiem. I love that.
So what about your first choice, then?
Well, it's interesting, you see, I did mention my love of the Fauré Requiem. This is a bit of Fauré, but it is something with a lovely melody. It's the Fauré Barcarolle. It's the number one in A minor, opus 26. Don't you think that's enchanting? That's lovely melody, isn't it?
Beautiful. That was played there, in fact, by Paul Crossley. He was the pianist there. Let's go back to your background. In fact, you're living not a stone's throw now from the place where you were born, aren't you?
That's right.
Is that a conscious effort? I mean, are you very
aware
of
it? Yes, I do like that. Yes, you're right. You've hit on something there because I like to be where the roots are. And I think where your roots are, to be reminded all the time of what you are, is a very, very good thing because it stops any sort of illusion, the folie du grandeur, you know? Everybody who gets on a bit in the world, every now and again I go to them, you know? I've visited people who live in very posh places. You know, I went once and there were servants and there's a chauffeur and a mews flat and all the sheesh. And I thought, blimey, this is the bloke I was at school with, you know? And they get to be a bit grand. And I think to myself, well, I don't want any of that. That's why I've always had the one-room kitchen and the bathroom. And I get rid of it, you know, shove the arpic down the loo, and I do it all myself. And that's one still, you see, a hangover too from the army, because that taught you to do your own darning of your own socks, sew your own buttons on. And I can do all those things for myself, and I've got the same apartment in the same sort of area that I grew up in. So I've not been subject to any false ideas about my station in life.
And I suppose if you had ever been, then your mum, who's been obviously been a big influence in your life and is still alive, she lives next door, doesn't she?
Yes, you mean she'd have brought me down with a bang.
I think so.
Yes, you're right. So was my old man. My father was a great one for saying, don't talk with a plum in your mouth, mate. Don't come here and talk with a... Because I say, hello, you can't get there, stuff with me. Don't talk with a plum in your mouth, he used to say. You don't remember where you come from. I was a van boy in the LMS, and that's what it was, a hell of a mess. You used to say that about the railway. That's how he began, you know. He was a van boy before he got the apprenticeship in hairdressing. And even at hairdressing, it wasn't much good because he had no diplomacy. I actually saw him and say, I would like Mr. Williams to have a henna dye. He said, you want to look like a tart? Henna dye on your head. Have you looked at your face? Want to look like a tart? I think somebody said, oh, do you think? Yeah, leave it as it nature intended, Mrs. Mrs. Instead of, you know, sort of, no, my dear, and a bit of diplomacy, a bit of flannel, you know. It's extraordinary. But, you know, like cockneys in pubs, you get often that quality, too, behind the bar. A bit of chai-iking, as they call it. Yeah. Like they will get away with a sort of rudeness that people think, oh, well, that isn't malign. It isn't nastily meant. He got away within his shop, because he was quite a successful hairdresser, you know, and doing the sort of things, Marcel waving, which was very much the fashion of the period, doing those sort of things, he was very good at it. And I think, you know, that it wasn't a disadvantage that he had no diplomacy.
Let's have another choice of record, please, Kenneth.
Well, now, this is a favourite. This is Kathleen Ferrier. I adore Ferrier. But I also love this, because it's an example of the art song in English, and we haven't got much of it. In Germany, you've got the whole tradition of Lieder, but we haven't got much of it in England. That's why I value Roger Quilter, because he said a lot of the Tennyson songs, and this is one of the songs from The Princess, which is a lovely Tennyson poem. And this is the song, Now Sleeps the Crimson Petal.
Now sleeps the crimson petal, now the wine.
Quilters Now Sleeps the Crimson Petal, sung there by Kathleen Ferrier. Kenneth, let's go back to this background you were telling us about with your mum and dad living in London. When did you get the first inclinations to be a performer, to be on stage?
Oh, I think the instinct was from my mother, Louisa, yes. I got it from Lou. Because she would come back from shopping expeditions or from the pub and say, and that woman came in, she pushed right in, she said, oh, excuse me, to a piping boy. Oh, excuse me, could I have half a penny of cigarette? I was giving these sort of impressions myself, you know. And I got that all from my mother. My father was very risk in that respect. He would never give you an impression. So he'd say, he'd come in here and I cleaned him, turn round and he said so-and-so, I said, get out of it. They were always turning round. Always. I turned round to him and I said, if you don't like it, get out. He turned round, he said to me, look here, mister. And I turned round and I said, look here. They were all turning round when I grew up. I sort of grew up in a world where all these incidents were dramatised, you know. And my mother loved popular songs, and she was always singing them. And I was shoved on the table, so the scrubbing was going on all round the table, and I wasn't allowed to put my feet in the way of new scrubbing, you see. And she sang things like, are you lonely tonight? Do you miss me tonight? You're sorry we drifted apart. You know, are you lonely tonight? She used to sing. And when she came to the line, does your memory stay for bright summer's day? She actually sang, do the chairs in your parlour, and then I thought she sang cementy and bare. So I thought this lover was covered in cement who worked on a building site, you see. It's much later I found out that it was, do the chairs in your parlour seem empty, not cementy. But my mother sang cementy and bare, and I never heard. I never heard, the diction was terrible. And so I grew up always trying to interpret all these things.
Right.
And so that's really what started off, the whole idea of acting and being...
Your father would surely want you to do a proper job, wouldn't he?
He didn't like anything to do with the acting profession. Mm. He said to me, all the women are trollops. The folks are all pains. I've had them in here with their... give us a blow wave. Oh, I fancy a bastard. Get out, I'll blow you. I'll blow you right off the bloody premises. Get out. But he had no time for them. He used to throw men out. He used to throw people out the shop. And wait for someone a little dying done or something. He thought it was terribly effeminate, you see. Now, you know, see how the climate's changed.
Yes.
If you go into a hairdresser today and say, I want my hair waved, they'd say, certainly, and just do it. Nobody would question it.
Did he live to be proud of you, though?
No, it wasn't that much proud, no. I mean, he did come, and he said, well, I thought I'd see your name up one day. And sort of grudgingly, that was when I had it up in neon outside the Apollo Theatre. But he did do that, but he wouldn't take the taxis. You and your mother can pay through the nose if you want to for a taxi. I'll get the bus and walk up from the circuit. And he went to pick himself on the bus. My mother said, oh, come on, I've got my dress on, Charlie. Let's have a taxi. Get out of it. I'm not paying their prices. 1 and 6 pence all the way to Piccadilly. I'm going to bus for Tums. Get out. It was all that. Get out.
Said he turning round.
Yeah.
I turned round and told him.
Yeah. Let's have another choice of record, please.
Yes, it's a Beethoven piece. It's I always call it the Spring Sonata. I tell you why I think it's marvellous. Because it shows the wealth of the man. He actually starts with a wonderful, wonderful little tune. I mean, it's a tune Adam Boys can whistle. It's so lovely. And then he actually just dispenses with it and goes on to another one. And you think, oh, how prodigal. How can you... And then you realise the enormous riches of this man. It's like a Shakespeare, you know. He'll give you a wonderful phrase, and you'll think, oh, that's incredible. And then follow with something equally wonderful. You think, oh, my goodness, the man's got loads of...
Part of the first movement from Beethoven's Spring Sonata, played by Itzhak Perlman and Vladimir Ashkenazy. Kenneth, you were mentioning there the sort of the way that you're always interpreting what people said as a young boy growing up. When you later came
onto the stage, and particularly I'm thinking about the characters you created in radio. How much did you draw?
Oh, enormously. Yes, I met a man who was selling papers outside Charing Cross Station, and I actually went up to him and said, I remember the occasion. It was about Churchill. It was worrying about his health. And he said, yes, the baby's head lanyards are sinking. Day's sinking lower. Are you going to sink altogether? Anyhow, we should get on with it. And the voice, you know, it was all like the back of the throat. Like, all, what do you call it, constricted, see? And I thought, that's a wonderful way to actually reproduce a voice. I use that voice a lot in radio. I use it for Grandfather. Coming on, I'd like to get my hands round Judith Chalmers. And I should do all this very hoarsely into the telephone. And it sounded really quite dirty. Because Judith Chalmers was then the sweetheart, you know.
That's right.
Yes. The Edward was a two-way network of the forces.
We have wonderful round-the-horn character, Jewel and Sam, that was written by Barry Toogan.
That was a clever idea, wasn't it? That was a very clever idea, because, you see, what Barry Toogan and Marty Feldman were doing there... Because I said, you know, I don't think this will be popular. They said, yes, it'll grow, Ken. Give it a chance, because what we're doing is to educate them, because we're going to say, all right, hitherto it's been regarded as esoteric to go into a whole load of jargon, but we'll make these two outrageous characters funny because of the manic insistence of the one making the other confess. So the one would say... Well, I went in, Miss Strawn. And I said, yes, you went in, go on. Well, Miss Strawn, I went in, and he said, yes, what did he say? Go on, what did he say? Go on, tell him what he said. Well, he got hold of me, and he said, yes, go on, what did he say about your eyebrows? Well, he said, you could do with plucking. Yes, Miss Strawn. This other one kept pushing the other one into terrible confessions, you see, which, I mean, they weren't really terrible at all when you actually worked them out. Yeah. But there was always this feeling that there was a sort of, I don't know, doppelganger, if you like, pushing the other one into admissions that he didn't really want to make. And life is full of such people.
I said also, too, in the introduction, it's perfectly true, that you've been involved in some of the masterpieces of radio. I mean, if one thinks of the Hancock's Half Hour as an example.
Yes, Hancock's Half Hour. Well, they had the brilliant scriptwriter, Gorton and Simpson. And I used to come in there, you see, with this character every week who said, oh, hello, put your little finger in mine. No, stop messing about. Come on. I used to do this dark voice about this man who kept saying, do little fingers, which is a brilliant idea.
Yes.
He was totally childish.
But it also upset Hancock, didn't it?
It upset him terribly, because he said, I don't want you coming on here halfway through the show, getting enormous rounds of applause, and destroying, he said, the pattern of the show, which should proceed, he said, like a real narrative every week, not like a variety show, which stopped in the middle by some character coming on and taking all the applause, you see. Look at it from his point of view, come up from the windmill, working very, very hard on things like Variety Bandbox, and eventually getting a series and making it. I suppose, you know, you would reasonably resent somebody who seems effortlessly to be walking on and getting away with anything, really, yes, getting away with murder, as I did.
But in retrospect, of course, knowing as we do with hindsight, it was obviously part of that sort of paranoia which in the end killed him.
Yes, because it became more and more destructive. It wasn't only getting rid of me, it was getting rid of Hattie, getting rid of Sid, and eventually... Galton and Simpson, which is unbelievable, isn't it? But you'd think you'd guard them like gold.
Absolutely. Another choice of record, please, Kenneth.
Well, it's As You Lull, and this is marvellous. It's a wonderful song. When I first heard it, I couldn't believe it, because it's a wonderful melody, and, you see, it's of special significance here, because it's saying, I think it's sung in Brazilian, but it's saying, in English, it would be saying, go, little bird, and tell them I'm lonely. So if I was on a desert island, you see, this is the perfect song for me to choose.
ingrata. Disque segne lauserta una
The Bluebird by Ovalle, sung by Gerard Souze. Kenneth, reading your autobiography, Just Williams, one's amazed by the range of people that you've worked with. I mean, everything from Hattie Jakes to Orson Welles, really, I suppose, Sid James to Maggie Smith, you know.
Yes, Maggie Smith to Edith Evans.
Yes, indeed. I'd like to ask you about that, you know, looking back, as you have to when you do an autobiography, what were the ones that really stand out? I mean, Maggie Smith was a kind of influential figure, wasn't she?
Oh, enormously, yes. I loved her comedy. She did things with beads in a thing I played, a sketch with her about a party hostess who said, here's a pencil and pad and you won't find it bad. These games we all of us know, pass them on as you write them and add infinitum, it's just party games, make a good party go. And this was rubbishy lyric, but she made it terribly funny because she had a row of beads which she swung around the neck, and then they swung around the shoulders, and they swung right round the breasts, then around the middle, and you thought, they're going to go off the frock entirely, because they were spinning these beads, and then she swung them all back, and so they were all round the top again. So she finished the song immaculate. And of course, it was the result of hard work. But it looked, when she did it on the stage, effortless. And that's a quality that really great comedians, I mean, the same with Alec Guinness, he'll practice something to perfection, and so that it ends up like a deft piece of wonderful comedy business. But it's the result of very hard work.
Can you see Maggie Smith growing into one of our favourites, Dame Edith?
Or I think she will be.
Yes.
I think she will, because she is so, what do you call it, singular.
Yes.
A unique actress. And I always remember there was one moment in the Schaffer plays when I said to her, you know, that's a very long speech where you talk about the failure of your marriage, and you're not breaking it up. I mean, it should be broken up. I mean, it can't be read like a monologue. And the moment, it's coming out of the monologue. And she said, I know that. I want 6 weeks to get that. And she did.
Yes.
She did exactly that. She got it in 6 weeks.
And what about Demi? Because you liked working with her, didn't you?
I loved it, yes. But she made a lot of objections. And I only heard about them afterwards. Because Binky Beaumont, who was presenting it, you know, he said to me, we had quite a bit of opposition, you know, when your casting came up. We used to have a casting, Kenneth Williams. And she said, Kenneth Williams? What casting Kenneth Williams for the wood god? A god? Kenneth Williams? And he said, well, now, why don't you like the idea, Dame Edith? She said, well, he's got such a peculiar voice. And I thought, what a cheat. What a nerd. Because I didn't know. And she invited me, you know, into her dressing room. We were on tour at Brighton, and she said, I can hear you halfway down the corridor talking to everyone in the company. Why don't they visit me? And I said, because they regard you as a great myth of the theatre. You're a big figure and formidable for them. I mean, see, I would have been my dressing room, just pop in and say, hello, what have you been doing? But they couldn't just pop in with you, they feel. She said, well, I'd like them to pop in. I'm very ordinary. I sit at home on a three-legged wooden stool, basting my joint. I like to baste my joint, and I make my Yorkshire pudding. And Johnny G comes down, Johnny Gilgood, and says, oh, dear, it is a Yorkshire pudding. And I thought, oh, dear, it's anything but ordinary. And she said, very ordinary.
Danny, a veg and two and Yorkshire pudding. You can hardly imagine it, can you?
Yes, she actually did order it.
Yeah. That's another choice of record, please, Kenneth.
Well, it's the Tchaikovsky Serenade, and I'll tell you why again, you see, because it's a magnificent melody. And what's wonderful about it, Michael, is that what he uses in the first movement, he inverts in the third, and it becomes another marvellous melody. But I love the first bit best.
Thank you. Part of the first movement from Tchaikovsky's Serenade for Strings, played by the Academy St. Martin in the Field, conducted by Neville Mariner. Kenneth, you've known everybody in show business, as I say, it comes through in your book, and yet you've never had a close relationship with anybody. Why is that?
Well, I suppose I've had some good friendships, but that's about all. I don't think it's given to us all. I remember the recent announcement by the Pope talking about this test tube baby business, and this marvellous sentence where he said, for some, it is natural they don't have any children, and they'll just have to accept it. And I thought, how wonderfully simple and honest. And that's the truth for hundreds of bachelors, I suppose. They are not meant to share in that way. So they share in some other way, and I've always had the advantage of an audience, you see. And this is an enormous advantage, because there's a whole wave of affection can go through an auditorium if your work turns out right.
But you've never had that sense of dynasty, of wanting somebody to continue what you are, what you have been?
Oh, heavens, no. No, nothing like that. No. I admire it when I read about it historically, when I read about famous families and the line, and I think that wonderful thing in Buddenbrooke's, the Thomas Mann idea, this family and this Hanseatic League and part of that whole tradition going on and on and on, and then coming to this terrible finality with the dropout, the one that doesn't quite fit. And I was fascinated by it, but it's not something that has been an ambition of mine, no. I think what you've got is something that's special to you, and you must look after it, do what you can, do your best with it, like Voltaire says, digging your own bit of garden, and be satisfied.
Another choice of record, please, Kenneth.
It's Tarega. And this is a composer I didn't really know much about, you know, until I heard Julian Bream playing him. He played some of Tarega. And this is a lovely tune. Now, I'm always on about tunes, aren't I? Because if I was on a desert island, I'd really need some good tunes, because it's good tunes that get me through the day. Yes. It's a mazurka, and it's called Adelita.
Mazurka Adelita by Tarega, played there by Julian Bream. You've done, as I say, this autobiography involves, of course, looking back and over your, what, 60 years now, isn't it, of life?
I'm 61, yes. And well, a professional would be about 40, wouldn't it?
Of course, easily. Would it be easy to remember, going looking back?
Well, no trouble at all, because I keep a diary, you see.
And you'd always kept a diary from being a child.
Oh, when I was 14, yeah.
Really?
Started with wanting to know how I progressed in terms of the apprenticeship, because when you're an apprentice, you learn something every week. And I thought, I must keep a record of all this, so that when I get my indentures, I've got an absolutely clear idea of how I developed. And I went to the army and still was able to practice draftsmanship, you know. In the REs, I went into the survey section.
Mm.
So I still kept it up. And I kept up the diary. But, of course, it all became different, you know. I mean, I started putting in bits of conversation, almost as a bit of entertainment for myself. You know, if I heard something funny, I put it all down.
And so it became a terribly useful compendium on which I could draw. And when it came to actually constructing the biography, there was no need for me to do any work. I just chose the bits I wanted to choose, you know? I mean, for information I hadn't got in the diary, like circumstances of birth, the day, the hour. I simply went to my mother and asked her. I mean, she knew it all. You know, I said, when was I? What can you remember? Of course I can remember when you were born, she said, your old man, your father, he had the Monday. It was always early closing Mondays, and he had the afternoon, so he was able to come to the birth, because it was the early day closing. You see, early closing day would be changed, say, to Thursdays when we moved to Marchman Street. But in the King's Cross area, it had been Mondays.
And was it a pleasant journey, looking back?
It was in some ways, but in others, it wasn't. It was almost salutary, the lessons that had to be learned, because I realised from much that I wrote in the early period what an arrogant little nasty person I was. You know, this terrible desire to show off and at somebody else's expense. And I think I've lost that now. I think I don't do that. But that business of picking people up, you know, if they make a mistake. Mm-hmm. And I pick people up occasionally. I did it very much to their embarrassment. And that's not the attitude of a gentleman. Somebody told me that when an Indian potentate of Buckingham Palace was dining with Edward VII, he picked up the finger bowl and drank from it. So Edward VII did the same. And they said that is the mark of someone who is a gentleman.
Another choice of record, please.
This is the trio number one, the B-flat major Schubert. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with it, but you'd be amazed because there's this particular second movement, which I love. You'd almost think, you know, you were in that scene in the Cadena Cafe in Brief Encounter.
Part of the second movement of Schubert's Trio No. 1 in B-flat, played by the Oistrakh Trio. Kenneth, what's in the future for you now? What are you going to do? What immediate
plans?
Well,
there are various things in the pipeline, you know. And there are always people sending in ideas. But a question of whether either theatrical management wants to do it or whether a television series wants, you know, whether the company wants to make a television series out of it. But I've got some irons in the fire, and they want me to do another book, too, because publishers said, as the book's done so well, you ought to do a follow-up, because your biography, Just Williams, only takes us to 75. And there's been a considerable lot happened since then.
Yes.
And you ought to do a follow-up. And I said, yes, well, I will. But of course, you need a bit of time to get the thing in perspective. I think, you know, you need another decade before you get that decade in perspective, don't you?
Exactly.
I really
so.
Do think you need a bit of time on that. So I'm not that keen. They said, what about an anthology of poetry? Now, that is what I'm interested in. But it would have to be very, very carefully selected, because so much of the poetry I adore would include an awful lot of stuff that people are still alive, you see. I mean, although I'm mad about 19th century poets, I mean, I love, of course, Austen, I love Tennyson. Mad about Tennyson. But then, of course, I'm mad about lots of moderns, like Larkin, you know? Mm. And I'm mad about people like that wonderful man that wrote Delamere. He was one to think about, is there anybody there for the traveller knocking on the moonlit door?
In the book, and on the programme too, you mentioned that you are thinking of, prepared for,
passing on.
Oh, yes, I quite look forward to death.
Quite look forward to death.
Yes, I just hope it's not painful. I don't want to kick up the backside with a bus or something. I've actually, I want it to be nice.
That being the case, have you thought of your epitaph?
No, it would have to be something as funny as Dorothy Parker when they said, what do you want on your tombstone? And she said, this one's on me. It had to be as good as that.
And the final choice of record, please.
Yes, well, it's appropriate, you see, because I did mention my love of Brahms earlier. It's the melancholy in me, the Norse melancholy. And this is one of the four serious songs of Brahms. It's the bit where, you know, it's under translation from Corinthians, Faith, Hope, and Charity, and the greatest of these is... And they don't say what we say, the greatest of these is charity. They say, und die Liebe, and the love. Und die Liebe ist die größte unter ihnen. The love is the greatest of all.
That was the fourth of Brahms' four serious songs sung by Hermann Pry. Kenneth, you're now on your desert island. You have to imagine that seven of your records have been washed away or destroyed. You're left with one. Which would it be?
Oh, well, it would have to be one which fired my imagination in dozens of different ways, so I would go for the Beethoven. Yes, the Spring Sonata.
And what about the book? Assume you've got the Bible, the works of Shakespeare.
Yes, well, it would have to be something full of variety, wouldn't it? So that I'd dip into and always find something to suit the mood. And the best thing I can think of in that direction would be Palgrave's Golden Treasuries. I don't think any anthology, though Larkin's comes near, but that's another matter because it's essentially verse, whereas this is all poetry. So it's the one I would choose, yes.
And what about the luxury object inanimate?
Well, it's a desert island, so though the sea water could be used to wash, you'd still be a bit, I think, smelly, so I'd want a crate of lovely cologne, and I would choose the La Plus Belle Lavandre by Caron. I'd have a whole crate of it.
Kenneth Williams, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Michael.